The Big E Sports Show with host Elissa Walker-Campbell just got bigger. Featuring former defensive star and three-time national champion at Nebraska and NFL player Jason Peter. Jason Peter under the helmet. With Jason Peter on the Big E Sports Show with host Elissa Walker-Campbell.
And we are back this weekend with the Big E Sports Show. I'm your host, Elissa Walker-Campbell. And before we get underway with our next interview, as always, we'd like to direct you to our radio website. That is eradiosports.com. And of course, right now we've been focusing so much talking about March Madness, but we're going to shift gears. We are now going to head out and talk about the NFL with our weekly Under the Helmet segment with three-time national champion, NFL former player, Jason Peter. How are you, Jason?
I'm good. How are you, Alyssa?
Hey, it's always a great time of year. I love hooping it up and into all the March Madness. But I do want you to weigh in on the former linebacker with the Chicago Bears, Brian Urlacher. Boy, big words coming out of that camp. Not a negotiation, but an ultimatum in terms of his contract. And the Chicago Bears, when you think about them, Jason, I mean, they're a defensive-minded team, but it seems like they're now headed in a different direction and they're going to be more offensive-minded, and they just lowballed Brian Urlacher in his contract. What were your thoughts when you heard this unfold?
Well, this is the cruel world of the NFL, and it doesn't matter how great you were. At some point, you just become somebody's old news, and it's a shame. You know, because I think when you think Chicago Bears, you think Brian Urlacher. And I know, my brother played in Chicago for a year, and Urlacher was the linebacker. And Christian has played with some good players over the years. I mean, he played next to Michael Strahan, who, is going to be a Hall of Famer, and there's just a lot of guys, I think, on that list of those superstars, I guess, that you've played with. And he said Urlacher is the best football player that he's ever played with.
Wow.
So when my brother said it, I just, to hear him say those things, because I would have guessed he would have said Michael Strahan, but he said, no, Urlacher is the best. And to see what Chicago offered him, a one-year, $2 million offer. I mean,
But $1 million of it was guaranteed, Jason P.
Yeah, I know. I mean, this is a guy that gave you 13 really, really good years. And, certainly there's been some injuries. I think he missed 4 or 5 games last year with maybe a hamstring, and a few years ago. He missed, 11, 12 games as well. But this is kind of the face of your franchise. And, without this guy, who becomes the face? Jay Cutler? I mean, is that really who you want to have out there representing your team? I mean, this is a guy who I think has even his own fans, his own supporters probably question him at times. I mean, with Urlacher, he was a Bear through and through. And to see this happen, I mean, Chase Daniel, who's a backup quarterback, just got a $3 million signing bonus in Kansas City. He's going to make more money, I think $3.8 million or something in 2013, and he'd probably hold a clipboard for the entire year. And you come to Brian Urlacher, who has done so much for this organization for 13 years, you're going to offer him 1 year, $2 million? I mean, it's just, this is, like I said, this is the tough part that I think all players, eventually get to. But, when you're a guy of Brian Urlacher's stature, I mean, I think you just would expect that the Bears would try to take care of this situation or end it maybe a little differently than a one-year, $2 million offer.
Well, Brian was very candid. I mean, he said it was insulting. It was somewhat of a slap to the face. And, of course, we're talking about Brian Urlacher, free agent the first time after 13 seasons. But do you think, your agent, you always want to, start high and then, work it down in terms of with the negotiation. He initially had sought a two-year $11.5 million deal. And then, you know, figured that, you know, eventually they were going to reach middle ground. I mean, I didn't think that was too outrageous. Do you?
No, I don't. And you can always add some terminology in that contract that says if you're injured, you know, the next year is voided, or, you know, I mean, there's just so many things, like what they did with Peyton out there in Denver. I mean, basically, he played on a one-year contract this year, and because Denver just didn't know what was going to happen with this guy. It, you know, it's hard to, especially with a guy, you know, with a neck, and I can speak from that, it's hard to know how somebody's going to react until you've really been thrown into that fire, until you've gotten ear hold. And it's not just a matter of, you know, running on a knee out in on the field and showing, you know, how you can cut and you know, showing stability of the knee. I mean, it's a little different, you know, with the neck. So for Denver, I mean, they basically had signed him to a one-year deal, but if it turned out where his neck was fine, then it, you know, it prolonged into a 5 or 6 year deal, or however long it is. I don't know the particulars of Peyton's contract, but yeah, I think there's too many options, and these agents and general managers can get very creative in the way they can set things up if they want things set up. But I think you're looking at a organization where Lovie Smith is gone, and you've got a new coach in there. You got a new GM in Phil Emery. Mark Trestman is the coach, and I think those guys are probably thinking, you know, do we really want somebody who's been around that long, who has as much power in the locker room as any player does in the NFL, as Brian Urlacher? Because if this guy, say, doesn't buy into everything that we're doing, he could ultimately kind of, you know, he can sway that feeling in the locker room. And if you're a coach, the thing that you dread the most is that all those players in that locker room, all 53 guys, don't believe in you. And you'll never win or never be successful if you don't have every guy in that locker room believing in what's coming out of your mouth.
Jason Peter with us this weekend on the Big E Sports Show. Of course, we want you to go to our radio website. That's eradiosports.com, and also Jason's website at jasonpeter.com. Of course, we're getting Brian Urlacher's perspective. And of course, he had talked about that the Bears, their offer was, quote, insulting. But help us see it from the owner's side. And as you said, it's a very cruel business. At some point, you know, you don't want it to be acrimonious. You don't want it to be a deep-seated resentment. But at some point, you do part ways. How could they have perhaps handled this better?
It's the difficult part. I think maybe they should have just went to him and said, look, Brian, we're going to go in a different direction. You know, the reality is that from the moment you step foot in an organization's facility, from the moment you sign your contract, they are the powers that be upstairs are already looking to find your replacement. And with Urlacher, he's, you know, lasted longer than I'm sure a bunch of the replacements that they may have had for him or waiting in the wings. You know, 13 years, most guys, you know, don't go past 3 years. So, you know, it's hard to say that there's any good way of dealing with it. You know, maybe they were hoping that Urlacher would have said, look, you know, I'm coming off a year where you know, I missed a handful of games, and you know, certainly not playing the way that I was back in 06 or whenever it was he won the Defensive Player of the Year award. You know, so maybe in their eyes they're just kind of hoping, well, maybe he's had enough. You know, maybe he doesn't want to put his body through another training camp or another season, and you know, maybe he'll just walk away. Well, they didn't walk away, but I think you owe him the respect to just say, look at Brian, then we're just going to, you know, let's just end this thing with a handshake, and you go your way, and we'll go our way. But, you know, offering him, you know, 1 year, $2 million, I think minimum wage for a guy that many years is probably around $1 million. You know, and is he a minimum wage guy?
Right, you're talking about a future Hall of Famer. It's crazy, crazy. Hey, Jason Peter with us. Just a few more minutes this weekend on the Big E Sports Show. And Jason, I hate to cut you off, but we got another couple of topics we want to hit on. And one of them is the player safety rules that were passed by NFL owners this past Wednesday, barring ball carriers from using the crown of their helmets to make forcible contact with a defender in the open field. Boy, this is certainly a great response from so many, not only the players today, but previous players.
Yeah, I think you're seeing a lot of the current players.
Strong reaction.
That are frustrated with it. And, you know, they feel like it's just, you know, you're asking for a knockout shot if you're asking them to run kind of with their head up and straight up. And, you know, I know Jim Brown has come out and said that he supports the rule because he doesn't. He never used his head, or you know, and it was a different game back then as it is now, I think, to some degree. And you know, certainly from the time when Jim Brown played, you know, guys have gotten bigger, faster, stronger, and you know, he's talking about, you know, he used to just use his forearm, or he would stiff arm him, and I think that's a move that certainly a lot of guys today use. But I don't know. I'm having a hard time wrapping my arms around this one. You know, I can understand when a running back is running in between that tackle box, and boy, you better have your pad level down. If you don't, you go, you know, walking through there with your head up high. Chances are you're going to catch a helmet right underneath your chin strap, and you know, you'll have bigger, I think, issues than, you know, just worrying about a 15-yard penalty or whatever the penalty may be. You know, you're probably going to end up with a concussion or a broken jaw or something. But I just think, you know, they're nitpicking here. You know, the thing that you're going to see now is if people thought it was a pass-happy league now, I mean, you know, everything is just favoring the pass. I think there's so many things as an offense that if you're a coach thinking, you know, do I call run here or do I call pass? You know, let's just take, for example, you know, a simple out route or something. If the quarterback throws the ball and completes it, great, he completes it. If not, he's got a chance that there's going to be holding, that there'll be pass interference, that there'll be illegal contact, that maybe there's a personal foul, maybe a hit on a defensive player. And that's just stuff that's downfield. Then you talk about protecting the quarterback, and you know, you can barely hit these guys anymore. There's so many things that can still work in your favor with throwing the ball, even if you don't complete the pass.
But Jason, will you say, though, let me jump in here, because, I mean, you have to appreciate, as a former NFL player, the priority, it does seem like, that owners are taking and having it at the forefront in terms of, you know, the pro health and safety.
I mean, I just don't know how many of these hits where you have a running back putting his head down, how many of those are resulting in the concussions, or, you know, where guys are carried off. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe, you know, it's something that's a bigger issue than maybe the fans know. I'm all about them doing and changing the game so that it's safer for these guys and that they don't have to deal with some of the health issues that a lot of us are dealing with.
And that you've had to go through.
Sure. I mean, I have the memory loss. I've had the depression. I've had all the, you know, I had, like I'm talking about it in past, have, and it's something that guys have a lot worse than what I have, and some aren't as bad. But, you know, it's still football, and you still, you know, you have a helmet on, and I understand it, you know, having a helmet on doesn't mean you have this pass to spear anything in sight. And, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with the form that kids are learning at a young age. I think a lot has to do with the media sensation, or, you know, the YouTube, and how kids can become famous, internet famous overnight if they have, you know, a big knockout shot in their high school game on Friday night and it gets put up on YouTube. Or, you know, there's just so much now where I think kids are drawn to that that big hit, the play that makes them famous, compared to the guy who tackles the right way, the guy who probably doesn't miss many tackles, and you know, the consistent guy. But he's also the guy that doesn't end up on ESPN. You know, so I think, you know, you're fighting that kind of battle as well. And, you know, you're talking about habits that are formed when these kids, for some of them it's Pop Warner, you know, probably no later than high school. You know, you're talking about 6, 7 years, 8 years, 9 years where guys are doing it a certain way, and then you get them into the NFL and you're saying, well, all of that, what you learned and what you've been doing for the last 9 years, we don't want you to do that anymore. This is what we want you to do. So it's tough, I think, to kind of retrain the body, especially in something where it's such a sport that's reactive in terms of the players. You know, you're just reacting to what you see in front of you. And, you know, lots of times you just don't have enough time to think about, oh, I'm not going to tackle the way I used to. I got to tackle the new way. So it's going to take some time, I think, for these rules to I think, for guys to be okay with them.
Well, it certainly is a compelling subject, and I'm sure, Jason, throughout the next few weeks, we'll talk some more about it as the reactions continue. Of course, Jason Peter has been with us this weekend on the Big E Sports Show with our weekly Under the Helmet segment. Always does a great job, and Jay, we'll talk to you next week, okay?
Thanks for having me.
You bet. We're going to step aside. Much more straight ahead here in just a moment. Hi, folks. Elissa Walker-Campbell here to tell you about our good friends at Mercer Well Service, who pride themselves on integrity, leadership, and complete customer satisfaction in the oil and gas industry. They truly understand what it takes to be successful. In fact, they've been providing outstanding completion and workover rig services for over 50 years. One of the key components and reasons that they have been able to have such longevity is their exceptional staff and experienced personnel to assist you 24 hours, 7 days a week. Mercer Well Service also provides a full line of completion and workover rig services that include 158 rigs and have 25 swab units. Did you know that Mercer Well Service yard locations include Cleburne, Jacksboro, Kilgore, Whitesboro, and Sweetwater, Texas, among many others? And they are equipped with mud pumps, mud tanks, hydraulic catwalks, pipe racks, and rig supervisors. Why not give them a call today at 940-668-5147. Mercer Well Service. Call them at 940-668-5147.
Elissa Walker-Campbell is on the air.
Asking the questions you want to know.
With sport's biggest and best name, Dallas Mavericks head coach Rick Carlisle.
And one of the ways you get high percentage threes is to get offensive rebounds and toss them back out. And if we don't get those rebounds, they're going to get them and toss them back out.
Now, rebounding is a massively important stat.
The fastest hour in radio. Big names, big sports talk. The Big E Sports Show, hosted by Elissa Walker-Campbell.
All righty, here we go. March Madness, it is underway. Millions of basketball fans have filled out their NCAA tournament brackets and, of course, have tried to predict the outcomes of every game. That doesn't always happen. It is never easy, and I have to admit, I guided our oldest son, Stephen, for the first time, helped him fill out his bracket, and it was such an enjoyable process. But today, on this weekend's program, we are not going to be previewing any of the weekend games. We're going to have a little bit of a history lesson and talk about how March Madness, how it has evolved and become this just American phenomenon. So we are absolutely delighted. It has been a year. It's been 12 months since we had Ken Rappaport on our program. He is the co-author of the book, The Big Dance, the story of the NCAA basketball tournament. We're going to talk about his passion and, of course, many others, the national passion of the Big Dance. Ken, how are you? How are things up in New Jersey?
Oh, they're
wonderful. I love New Jersey. I love my life. I really have been. We actually just moved to South Jersey a little while ago, so we're still getting adjusted here.
Yes, we were talking about that before the program, and I know that you haven't slowed down, though, anyone, in terms of, you know, writing books. I mean, you love sports history, and I must share with our listening audience, I mean, you're the author of over 50 books, and you've written about every major sport. Even for young readers, you've produced some books there, too. But where does this particular book, The Big Dance, the story of the NCAA basketball tournament, where does this rank?
Well, for me, it's one of the most exciting sports events ever. I remember working for the Associated Press in New York for 30 years, I had the opportunity to be the college basketball writer for the AP for many years. And covering the Final Four, to me, was always very exciting, maybe the most exciting sports event, you know, ever. A lot of things going on, you know, especially the Final Four, which is always very exciting. So I've been lucky. I've been able to see some really special games, you know, including the time that UCLA had its winning streak stopped in 1974 by North Carolina State, which to me was one of the great events in the sport. But anyway, I love my passion is sports, and I love to write, and so I've been very lucky in this life to do so.
Well, the one thing, Ken, as I've gone through the book and looked through it, that I took away from it is it really is, as you step back, it's amazing to just to reflect on the growth, the history, and how the tournament has just exploded. I mean, back in the day, you're talking an 8-team tournament, and now, forget millions, it is a $10 billion, with a B, $10 billion business. I mean, tickets used to be given away. I thought that was really interesting. Kind of tell us about a little bit of those early days and how it has evolved.
Well, yeah, I mean, the National Invitation Tournament, the NIT, was actually the original national championship. But a lot of those schools in the tourney back in 1939, that goes way back, doesn't it? The NIT then was what's considered the true national champion. The NCAA sponsored that, and they had most of their games were played in New York at Madison Square Garden. And so, therefore, it was really considered mostly an Eastern tournament with, you know, as close to New York and Philadelphia in it. But 1 year later, coaches decided to, you know, have their own championship event. And that's how the NCAA was formed in 1979. 1978 was the NIT. 1979, the NCAA joined the group.
Let me jump in here, Ken. What was the turning point for the tournament where it really took off and it had, you know, started growing by leaps and bounds? Because that first championship game, it was televised, in 73? And I tell you what, I mean, they had a record audience. They had 13.5 million. That may not seem like a lot now, but I mean, hey, that's some good viewership.
Yeah, I think that was a turning point, especially with an audience, you know, with that size audience and television made an impact, too. Of course, the big game was even a few years later in 1979 when Magic Johnson played against Larry Bird in the national championship.
Yes.
And it was, Michigan State beating Indiana State. And that created a lot of interest, that rivalry, and brought a lot of attention to the Final Four. And the year after, it really exploded.
You're listening to the voice of Ken Rappaport. The book that he has co-authored with Barry Wilner is titled The Big Dance, The Story of the NCAA Basketball Tournament. And I'm going to assume, Ken, you can go anywhere online and pick up a copy of the book, right?
Yes, you can find it mostly if you Google me. And you can actually find it on Amazon.com mostly, but also on the Barnes & Noble site.
Well, when we think back about those early days of the tournament, let's fast forward. You think about in 2011, the NCAA added three more teams to make 68 for the field. Can you weigh in on that? What are your thoughts about as far as the addition of teams? Because some folks have been critical of it, and they say, hey, there's just too many. It's diluting the tournament.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I mean, if they went from 64 to 100, I would say, yeah, no, that's not a good thing. But, I mean, this is only a point of maybe, you know, just a few teams more. And I don't think it hurts anything. You know, there are always some complaints, no matter how large the field is, there's always someone who's unhappy, you know. So, I think right now, if the NCAA held serve on 68 teams, I think that's an excellent number. You know, I don't think they have to go any, you know, more than that, I don't think.
Ken Rappaport is with us this weekend on the Big E Sports Show. Of course, you can listen to this entire interview at eradiosports.com. And I tell you what, I think back to the 90s. You were highlighting perhaps some of those great games from the early days. But how do we ever forget Duke versus Kentucky? That's, in my mind, the greatest game. And, of course, Christian Laettner with that, you know, fake the turnaround jumper, and he nails it. That was so special. I can remember exactly where I was.
Well, that was a remarkable game to end. One of the most exciting ever in the tournament.
It was crazy, yes.
And you know, Grant Hill had to throw a pass from the other end line of the court, okay? So he had the way Laettner was stationed in the middle there above the key, he was ready to accept the pass, but Grant Hill had to get him the pass first. So that basically was throwing a football style pass most of the court. Laettner had to catch it, turn and shoot all in one motion. And to me, that was like a memorable play, much like Willie Mays's catch in the 1954 World Series.
Very well put. Ken Rappaport with us this weekend on the Big E Sports Show. As we take time to highlight the book, The Big Dance, the story of the NCAA basketball tournament. And, you know, we highlight and talk about some of the greatest games, but you also did include in this guys and gals that have made a real difference with men and the women's game, coaching giants. And right at the top, of course, is John Wooden. I mean, how was he able to sustain such a high level of consistency and unprecedented? You were just talking about all those championships. There were 10 of them, and he was the Wizard of Westwood.
Yes, actually, you know, Wooden had, and let's not forget, he had two of the most dominating centers in the history of college basketball with Lou Alcindor and Bill Walton. But Wooden won with small teams, medium-sized teams and large teams. He, I don't know, it was just, you know, he was in UCLA for 16 years before he won his first championship, so it really didn't happen overnight. But Wooden's teams were so well-conditioned that all he had to do was, once the game started, they were ready to play, you know. And all he had to do was sit and watch. He didn't have to do too much managing. The UCLA players knew exactly what they had to do, and they were in such great condition, too. I mean, no team was, in that kind of shape in those days. And of course, he had Lou Alcindor with the three championships, and Walton with two. And incidentally, Bill Walton played in one of the greatest games ever. The year was 1974, and UCLA had a long winning streak in the playoffs. I think they had won seven straight championships at that time. And North Carolina State knocked them off in the national semifinals in the Greensboro in a tremendous game. They won a double overtime.
And that, of course, was what, in the 74 season, is that right?
Yeah.
I think back to, and you know, I wasn't around at this time. I would love to get some game tape on this. The 67-68 season with Lou Alcindor, the Big A versus the Big E, Elvin Hayes, UCLA versus Houston. And they played in the regular season, I think it was in January that they played, and then they ended up facing each other in the national semifinals where UCLA went on to win.
Yeah, what happened was Lou Alcindor had actually actually scratched his eye in one of the games leading up to his matchup with Hayes in Houston. And he was not at his best. And Houston, with Hayes leading the way, stopped UCLA that night. And then, ironically, the Bruins then again saw Hayes in the finals, and they just wrecked him. They just wiped him out. And this time, Alcindor was at his best. He was, he was healthy and in good shape. But what a rivalry.
Absolutely. And you're talking about two of the best college players at that time. Just incredible. Like I said, I'd love to go back to those archives and look at some of that game tape. Hey, Ken, as we get ready to wrap up our interview, I thought it was really wonderful. Of course, I love women's basketball, played at the University of Oklahoma. And you did dedicate a chapter in here, you and Barry, to it's not only a man's game. And you did highlight and feature so many of the great coaches that have made an impact with our game, Gina Auriemma, Pat Summitt, and some of the outstanding women players that have been a part of it as well. And you really see the residuals and the impact that Title IX has certainly had with the women's game. And of course, we're reaping those benefits today with the growth and the television exposure.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And we were so happy to do that. I mean, we thought it was just as important to highlight the women's game as it was the men's game, I thought, because that's certainly, a part of our sports history and should not, should not go undetected, I should say. But anyway, we love doing it, and because we love sports history. I love sports history. I love writing about it. That's my passion, and I'm really quite fortunate that I'm able to do that and help to preserve some of the great moments in sports history.
Well, I love it. The Big Dance is the title of it, and it is a chance to, hear and learn from some of the sport's best teachers, and so many of them that you and Barry had featured, John Wooden, Coach K, Pat Summitt, and just so many of those great games that have been a part of it. So I'm sure that you could do another book, as I'm assuming that you've got other projects coming up too, right, Ken?
Oh, yeah, always. In fact, I'm working on something called Crazy Ball now, so I'm not quite sure what it's about.
Well, you've not slowed down one bit, and enjoy your time in New Jersey, and perhaps next year at this time, we'll be catching up with you and maybe a brand new book that is out. So, Ken, blessings to you. Congratulations on the book. It is titled, once again, ladies and gentlemen, The Big Dance, the story of the NCAA basketball tournament. And as Ken said, you can go anywhere online, Google the title of the book, and you can pick up a copy of that. Ken, thank you so much, okay?
Okay, thanks very much for having me.
You bet. We're going to step aside much more straight ahead here in just a moment and join us online at eradiosports.com.